Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine last week established the Ohio School Safety Center, which begins operations today that include resources to scan social media and other websites for threats. Some are calling for guardrails around those measures to ensure student privacy and equity. Amelia Vance is Senior Counsel and Director of Education Privacy at the Future of Privacy Forum. That's a think tank that advocates for data privacy. Welcome, Amelia Vance.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're one of those folks who have called for these guardrails. What do you mean by that?
Absolutely. So what we mean is that communities should absolutely adopt the school safety measures that they think are necessary for their community. But we want to make sure that they don't have unintended consequences, that they don't actually harm students more than they help ensure school safety. So guardrails include things like being transparent with the community, making sure if you're collecting social media information, you delete it. Nobody wants a record that follows students for the rest of their life, especially when that record is, you know, 11 or 12-year-old pictures on Instagram. And we want to make sure that when it comes to mental health information or things like that, that we're not deterring kids from seeking help by so closely monitoring networks that they feel there's no space to look up why they're so sad or look up help that may be needed that could help them move forward.
When you talk about unintended consequences, are there examples out there now of unintended consequences of this strategy?
There's quite a few, especially when it comes to social media monitoring. There's numerous stories of students who typed the wrong word, at least according to whatever was monitoring social media, and ended up suspended. You've had kids that have posted pictures of BB guns or other things that are taken very seriously, understandably, but then end up with them being suspended or at a totally different school or dropping out of school together. You have other students that have gone through the threat assessment process, which is intended to make things better for students, to make sure students get the help that they need. But what we've seen is that in some cases, these threat assessments are discriminating against students with autism, students with other disabilities, and parents aren't informed why their kids are being targeted. And at the end of the day, those students aren't threats. They're simply students who need additional help. And if schools had policies in place to make sure that there are privacy and equity guardrails, that would be dealt with much better.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, the Ohio School Safety Center was established. It begins operations today, and those operations include resources to scan social media and other websites for threats. It's something that districts across the country are already doing. My guest is Amelia Vance. She's Senior Counsel and Director of Education Privacy at the Future of Privacy Forum. That's a think tank that advocates for data privacy. What about First Amendment rights, Amelia Vance? Who gets to draw the line when it comes to personal expression versus a threat?
That's been something that's incredibly hard for schools to deal with. They're able to punish speech that interferes with the daily operations of the classroom. And in today's digital world, where the things that happen, you know, cyberbullying or inappropriate pictures or other things take place on sometimes a school-owned device or on social media, it absolutely trickles back to the classroom. And so right now you have a variety of court cases across the country all contradicting each other about how far the school should go past its gates to regulate or punish speech happening outside of school.
And how are those things affecting school districts? What's happening?
A large part of it is obviously that schools do not have capacity to do that much monitoring without taking resources and personnel off of other things. So in Florida, for example, one of the things that they've done for school safety is creating a social media monitoring system that they say it's optional. Schools can log into, but they don't have to. The thing is, once you start that monitoring, it's a matter of liability for schools if they're not checking in. And so all sorts of time that personnel could have spent helping students, doing various administrative tasks, which could make schools safer, are now going to be spent checking in on this portal and sifting through hundreds upon hundreds of false flags from, you know, someone shooting hoops to this ice cream is the bomb or things like that, which are obviously not threats, but schools still have to spend time on if they are obligated to use this technology.
What about the issue of implicit bias? I mean, if there's humans reviewing the data, or even if it's algorithms that have been taught by humans, there is that issue, isn't there?
Absolutely. That is a huge issue and occurs even in things that you'd think are objective. So, for example, video surveillance. One of the best examples I ever got from a district administrator was, you know, you think about video as being objective, being something where bias isn't going to come into play. But if you're looking at a video in the hallway of a school and you see a Black kid reaching into the backpack of another kid, what's your assumption going to be? A lot of people may assume that they're perhaps stealing something, whereas if it was a white kid reaching into a backpack, they might assume that that student was simply, you know, borrowing something from a friend. And so that will affect the discipline. And we know that there are disproportionate suspensions of minority students, of students with disabilities across the country. Mm-hmm. And therefore, implicit bias is absolutely going to come into play as we adopt more and more of this technology.
And taking it out of the hands of humans and putting in into the digital hands of an algorithm doesn't necessarily help, right?
Absolutely. In fact, we've found that oftentimes a lot of the social media monitoring algorithms are more likely to pinpoint slang in minority communities and other things, because at the end of the day, you're dealing with basically recipes created by humans, and the technology is only following those recipes. And so if the humans have bias, whether explicit or implicit, that's going to make its way into the tech.
You mentioned transparent, that the districts should be transparent. What do you mean by that? I mean, I know what the word transparent means, but how does that apply in this issue?
So it's really important that schools are specific about their safety objectives. Are they trying to, first and foremost, regulate visitor management? Are they trying to prevent cyberbullying? Do they have a lot of self-harm occurring? And so the transparency comes into play in two places here. First and foremost, it's as schools are creating their school safety plans, as they're deciding what to adopt, they should be talking with their community. They should be talking with students and parents and educators about what actually are the safety concerns in their district, in their school, because that's going to change what technology they need to adopt and where they need to spend their limited resources. The other area where technology or where transparency comes into play is once a student is going through a threat assessment or something like that, it's really important that schools are communicating with the parent and the student and the wider community about what is going on. Why was that student picked to undergo a threat assessment? Because the parent and student may very well have information or evidence that pushes back on whatever it is and settles the issue.
And give me an example of transparency. I mean, is that the example of what you mean? When somebody is being investigated, they need to be given all the information that led to the investigation?
I wouldn't say all the information, but there was a really great story out of Oregon done by reporter Bethany Barnes, where she basically followed a family for a year where their son underwent a threat assessment. And in that case, the parents weren't told what initiated the investigation. They were just sort of given vague information. Their son was, you know, being called a shooter. He dressed in a way that sort of stereotypically was referred to as being a potential threat. He had an obsession with knives. many of these things were aspects that were related to his autism, to his disability. And so when they finally found out what had initiated the investigation and the reporter went to the student who had used the word shooter, the student was really embarrassed because they said the word was being used as a derogatory term from other students. And so this whole investigation that took place over a year, the student eventually basically dropped out of school, could have been avoided if the parents had known, if the school had gone back to the student initially talking about this. And so this is what I mean by transparency. It really is about making sure that the actions the school is taking are necessary. And the way that you do that is through robust communication.
You've said that districts should restrict the search to serious threats to school safety. What does that even look like? How do you know what serious is?
I mean, all of it is a matter of degrees, and it's going to vary by community. Oftentimes in these situations, we know that there are copycats. We know that there are certain things that may trigger certain actions, and so it is going to vary. But perhaps the best way to talk about it is if you're adopting social media monitoring, the focus should be on threat prevention, on not necessarily punishing innocuous, unimportant violations of school policy. Instead, it should be focused on what are the most serious actions? What are things that could lead to a school shooting, a student harming themselves or others? That's really the focus there, especially when you're adopting a technology that requires that students communicate with the school. Oftentimes, these threats are best prevented by other students saying, my friend is going through this thing, or my friend said this thing, and I don't know they're serious. If students think that the school is going to focus on innocuous violations, the equivalent of jaywalking, then they may not be inclined to tell school administrators things. If they know that the focus is going to be on the most serious threats, on preventing harm to self or others, then they're going to be much more inclined to work with the school to prevent those threats.
Are you concerned, Amelia Vance, that this may not even be a role for schools to play?
Not really. I mean, I think schools, as parts of the community, as a place where students spend the vast majority of their day, where teachers really are the people who, with parents, know these children best, I think schools absolutely have a role to play here. The key is making sure that you're differentiating between the school's role and law enforcement's role, because getting a student involved in the juvenile justice system is a very different thing than the school going through a process to make sure all students are kept safe.
Except that when it forces students to resign or to leave school, forcing them to change schools, that kind of a thing, when the district might be kind of ham-hocked about how they carry out the policy.
Absolutely. I mean, part of it is making sure that there's a policy in the first place. There's a number of districts that we've seen that just haven't thought of the privacy and equity issues that we've been talking about, and therefore haven't thought things through. Okay, we have social media monitoring. What if a student is being abused at home? What if a student is LGBT? What do we do when a parent comes and asks for a record? Do you have a policy of when parents are able to access that? Again, how long are you keeping the information? All of those steps and others are things that schools aren't necessarily thinking about, particularly when states are saying, well, adopt this technology because it'll help keep students safe. And the follow along, and what's next, isn't part of that instruction from the state or from some school safety advocates.
Amelia Vance, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amelia Vance is Senior Counsel and Director of Education Privacy at the Future of Privacy Forum. That's a think tank that advocates for data privacy. We've been talking about this today because the new Ohio School Safety Center, which begins operations today, includes resources to scan social media and other websites for threats to schools or their students. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Facebook tracks user data outside its social media site and uses it to sell and target ads on its site. In coming months, Americans should be able to reclaim some control of that data from Facebook. Ryan Mack is senior technology reporter for BuzzFeed. He wrote about the policy change. He joined us by Skype. Welcome, Ryan Mack.
Thanks for having me.
How far can Facebook track you on the internet? Are there any limits that exist?
It can go quite far. So this isn't, Facebook can track you not only on its site, which I think people are aware of. So whenever you're browsing Facebook or Instagram, which is another Facebook property, but it can also go across the web. So a third of all websites, according to some studies, have some type of Facebook tracker on them. And so that means, let's say if I go and visit Levi's.com and look for a pair of jeans, Levi's.com will have a Facebook tracker on that and will send information back to Facebook, and that'll help target ads when I'm on the platform.
So this is a collaboration between Facebook and all of the vendors that want to advertise on the social media website.
Yeah, I would say it's beyond a collaboration at this point. I think it's become an accepted norm to have some type of Facebook tracker on your site. I mean, whether that, and if a tracker could mean anything, it's a piece of code that can be, let's say you have a login with Facebook button on your site, or you have a like button on your site, that those bits of code will then end up transmitting information back to Facebook, Facebook servers. And I guess that's kind of the way the internet works these days, is having these things on your site.
Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook founder, made the announcement about this tool last year at the F8 Developers Conference, and you wrote that was just a public relations move. What do you mean by that?
So back then, you remember it was spring of 2018. The company was undergoing a number of crises at the time. Of course, there was the Cambridge Analytica scandal. There were various other privacy scandals, data breaches as well, that basically put the company in this kind of siege mentality. And at the time, Facebook was coming up on its developers conference, this conference called F8. It holds every year for its developers on the platform. And it wanted to kind of put out a public showing that it was acknowledging its issues and that it was doing something to correct them. What people didn't know was that tool called Clear History at the time was essentially just dreamed up on the spot. A couple days out, they put together a presentation. They eventually announced it at F8 in May 2018, but it would take a while to kind of put this thing together, to get it operating, and to get it sorting through all these massive reams of Facebook data. And that's why it hasn't launched until now.
And it hasn't launched everywhere. It's just in a few countries, right?
Right, and only for a certain subset of users in those countries. So I believe the countries right now are Spain, Ireland, and South Korea. We've been trying to find people that have actually been able to use it and have been kind of unsuccessful. So it's kind of been a pretty slow rollout in those countries as well.
So a certain subset, what subsets are you talking about?
I'm not clear, actually. I mean, the company won't say, but they're saying right now it's in those three countries. You'll just happen to get it if you're in those countries, and eventually it'll slowly make its way to other users.
Will it be a pop-up that says you can opt out of this, or how does that work?
No, that's the thing. So I think, I can't speak for Facebook, but it's not a good thing that if people kind of engage with this feature. I mean, obviously Facebook wants as much data as possible to target ads and make its ads as accurate, I guess, as they would say, towards your needs. So this feature is in your settings. So you have to kind of opt in. You have to access your settings. You then have to go through a series of steps and then engage this this tab called Off Facebook Activity. And then once you're there, it gives you a couple options for disengaging, I guess, your web browsing history from your profile.
Does it have to be that complicated?
No, certainly. I mean, nothing has to be.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, are they doing it just to reduce the number of people who participate in it eventually, or we don't know?
I don't want to speak to Facebook's thinking here, and there's people that get paid a lot of money to figure out how to do product design and user interface and user experience. Mm-hmm. That can probably speak to this. But it's not like you're going to access Facebook one day and it's going to give you a giant red pop-up and say, hey, here's how to disengage all your web browsing history. I mean, Facebook is just not going to do that. That's the core of their business. So if you want to do this, you're going to have to read up on it. You're going to have to go through all these steps. And at the end of the day, I think this is the biggest thing. You're not exactly clearing your history either.
What do you mean? It's not going backwards and getting rid of stuff that's already collected on you?
So what this means, and this is actually kind of where I think the biggest misconception is the tool was originally marketed as Clear History. And in the tool itself, there is a button called Clear History. But you're not actually going back and deleting all your web browsing history from Facebook servers. What you're doing is you're disengaging it. So I have web browsing history. Let's say I go to Levi's and I go to all these other shopping sites. Facebook has taken in all that data. What I do when I hit that button is that Facebook will cut off my profile from that data. So it'll no longer link that profile, but it will keep that data and in a kind of an anonymous aggregated fashion. So my profile will no longer be linked to that data, but it will still remain on Facebook servers anonymized and no longer connected to me.
We are talking about proposed plans by Facebook to give all of its users an opt out when it comes to how Facebook tracks user data of its users on social media. My guest is Ryan Mack. He's a BuzzFeed senior technology reporter. He's been writing about this. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Melissa in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I wondered if it matters at all if you log out of Facebook or any other certain app. Does that make any difference at all?
If you're not logged into Facebook, Ryan Mack?
If you're not logged in, no, it doesn't make too much of a difference. I mean, let's say you're browsing and you log out of your Facebook and you go on Levi's again, just use that example, mm-hmm. Levi's will still have ways to connect that back to your profile.
Right, and they just save the data for Facebook. I mean, it's just shipped to them, right? They can identify you're a Facebook user.
Right, and there's many ways that they can collect data on you. You don't have to be logged in necessarily for them to be collecting that data.
Okay, Melissa, thanks a lot for that call. You make the salient point that this is how Facebook makes money, so they're not going to eliminate the way they make money. Why did they start with Ireland, South Korea, and Spain? Is it because there's less of a money-making loss potential there, or what?
I'm unclear, and I can only speculate. I mean, Ireland, I can speculate on Ireland because Ireland is the main enforcement arm that the EU is using for GDPR-type violations. And so right now, a lot of people are looking at Ireland as kind of to kind of set the example here. And so I guess I don't know if Facebook's garnering goodwill here by launching their first, but I guess you'd have to ask them as to why they picked the other two countries as well.
Yeah, they're not really talking that much, though, are they?
They talk to certain talking points, and they have their blog posts, and they have their announcements all over the place. But yeah, when you really want to dig into it, it can get a little difficult.
And are they going to announce as they roll it out in other countries? Do you know that?
That's a good question. I actually don't know that. And I can certainly pose that to Facebook. But yeah, that would be certainly helpful, right? If to know that, hey, in the United States on Friday, we're actually getting this. But no, Facebook has not done anything like that. And I kind of don't think they will, if I had to guess.
Short of getting off Facebook and eliminating an account on Facebook, is there anything users can do at this point to stem this or not? I mean, I suppose there's some users out there, are there not, Ryan Mack, that don't mind it, that ads are popping up that they care about?
I think so. I mean, I think that's right. I think some people probably do enjoy targeted ads, but I think you have to weigh what the cost is. I mean, if you want this multi-billion-dollar, if not trillion-dollar company holding all this personal data on you for the rest of your lives. I mean, for a lot of people like myself who have had Facebook since high school, I mean, this is a lot of data that this company has been collecting on you for eternity. And even if you delete that account, whether that's your Facebook account or your WhatsApp account or your Instagram account, not even just logging out, even if you delete it, that data will still remain on Facebook servers. Sure, they can anonymize it. They can aggregate it, but they keep that data for forever or for however long they want to. And so that there's that trade-off you have to think about. I think a lot of people are considering that now, especially with the last year.
You called the 2018 announcement a PR stunt. Do you think this is just a furtherance of that?
I think everything has an element of, I guess, trying to appease public opinion and again, you have to realize that last year was a terrible year for Facebook optically. And, I mean, financially it was actually great, but optically,
I was going to say, they're suffering all the way to the bank, right?
Right. And, but if you look at how it's being viewed by the public, how it's being viewed by lawmakers, Facebook is no longer this kind of force for good that 5 years ago people may have thought it was this great kind of wonderful thing for the internet. Mm-hmm. And that reputational damage may be kind of irreversible in a way. So at the beginning of this year, Mark Zuckerberg kind of announced this whole shift. I mean, Facebook is now going to focus on more private modes of communication. It wants to be not only the town square, but also the living room where people can have protected conversations with the ones they love and the ones they know. And so they've kind of pivoted towards these new goals. And we'll see how that turns out.
Mm. You know, just going forward, you know, you mentioned the EU is a little stricter on these issues than the United States. Any sense about when Congress might take up these issues and actually enact some regulations?
Yeah, the EU has, of course, enacted GDPR, mm-hmm. Which is a pretty decent privacy protection for its citizens. The U.S. government has kind of, Congress has kind of waffled on this. Individual states have, of course, pursued their own laws, California being one of them. Mm-hmm. But in talking to lawmakers, it doesn't seem kind of top of mind for them. A lot of focus right now on legislation with regards to technology companies. There's obviously a discussion around antitrust and whether we should break up these companies. There's discussion on the conservative side about censorship of voices on these platforms, and so privacy is kind of on the lower rungs here on the discussion.
Well, Ryan Mack, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Max, BuzzFeed senior technology reporter, has been covering the question of when and where and how Facebook tracks user data outside its social media site. It is starting to give people in Ireland, South Korea, and Spain the option of opting out, but no one's quite figured out how to do that yet because there's so few people who have done it. So stay with us. We will follow that one as it unfolds over time, and we'll have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Netflix is testing a new way to curate videos in a novel move. The entertainment streaming company wants to compare human curation to algorithms. Russell Holly is contributing editor at Android Central. He joins us. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Why is Netflix doing this?
I think the goal here is to find better ways of getting people's attention for what to watch next. This is the big thing that Netflix has always wanted. It's not to, you know, recommend something for you to watch. It's to recommend the next five or six somethings for you to watch. And it's really important for Netflix right now to figure out the best way to get you to keep watching the next thing, because you're not allowed to stop watching. You have to continue watching.
Right. I mean, Netflix can't be the only company, the only entertainment streaming company that's thinking about this. I mean, Prime, Hulu, all of them are doing it, right?
Yeah, that's the general idea here is, you know, there's always been some kind of recommendation engine, but most of the recommendation engines have been are just that. They're you know, based on algorithms. You've watched these things. Here are other things that are in that same genre that you might like. And that is certainly useful to a certain degree. But the idea here is to make sure that a human hand is involved for things like, you know, you liked the way that the actor, you know, the lead actor in this particular show did. Here's something else where they were also really good. Not just, you know, not just here's something else that has their name on it, which is what an algorithm would do. This is here's something else that, you know, that critics said were really great for, you know, that actor, or that had, you know, similar kind of gripping scenes or compelling comedy. You know, the human touch there is a way of creating more recommendations that are more in line with what people who enjoyed a single show would be able to enjoy.
Well, all right. So the star of the marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Rachel Brosnahan, had a really interesting role on House of Cards, but that's prime for the marvelous Mrs. Maisel and Netflix for her role in House of Cards. Is this just to get you to the next Netflix show? Not necessarily. Right.
Well, it's the next thing that's on Netflix, not necessarily the next thing that was made by Netflix.
Gotcha.
You know, so you know, the big thing there is to have the recommendations be better for this entire system, to have them be more relevant to the people who are watching. And the trick there is you have to have people who are you know, diverse enough in thought to be able to offer something that fits everyone. You know, if someone is a huge comedy buff and is offering recommendations for a horror series, they're probably not going to recommend something that you know, that I'm particularly interested in if I'm only interested in this because it was super scary.
Yeah.
You know, so it has to be, you know, the curation team that Netflix has to be you know, great at the particular category that they are creating recommendations for. And that's the big thing that Netflix is testing here is, you know, by having people who are specialized to create these recommendations, are they going to create, you know, are they going to create options that are more accurate or more compelling than the things that the algorithms are currently creating for them?
Is this just a way to teach the algorithms to do something differently?
It is certainly possible. You know, that's not the direction that Netflix is suggesting right now. The big thing is that if this becomes popular, then at least for the immediate future, this could be a permanent thing that is accessed across the entirety of Netflix. Right now, this feature is only limited to is limited to anything that is running on iOS. So iPhones, Apple TV, and iPads, and things like that can access this human curated function. But the goal here is to test, you know, to see how, you know, people are going from one show to the next. And if it is successful, then it's something that they will see a lot more of, and kind of let the algorithm part take a backseat for a little while. And it could be that the purpose there is for it to learn a little more.
Is the idea, will success look like just if, as long as you keep staying on Netflix, that's success?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's the big thing.
That's the bottom line.
If you move from one show to another and then you stay on that show for a while, because, you know, the recommendation system is not great if you go from one show to the next and then you only watch one or two episodes and you go thumbing around for something else. The goal is for Netflix to kind of immediately have you excited about the next thing and have you watch it in its entirety.
Ergo binging.
Right.
What's the sense about how it's going to work? I mean, they're going to hire people to do this. Will you be able to pick a human curated suggestion?
You will not be able to pick the person, but the collections feature on iPhones will be, you know, part of Netflix's creative team instead of just something that's done by, you know, by the robots. So the whole deal here is to have the recommendations just be a little more personable. And then hopefully that's something that works. It's not clear how long it will take for Netflix to feel like it has enough information to make this decision. Mm-hmm. It could be something that is a couple weeks. It could be something that is a couple months. It really just depends on, first of all, how many people watch Netflix exclusively through their phone. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, how much data they're able to grab from those people as they go to watch.
Is Netflix saying that you'll know if the suggestion is from a human or not?
No, just that if you're on an iPhone and you're in the collections function right now, it's curated by the creative team. Okay. It won't specifically say that people were involved.
Okay. All right. Interesting. We'll see how that pans out. There is a new Nokia 3V phone available just at Verizon. What makes this one so special?
Yeah, so this is, you know, the continuation of Nokia phones that look kind of surprisingly high-end and are available in particularly low prices, and they're available here in the U.S., which are a coordination of things that don't always happen at the same time. This phone is it's got a huge screen, the 6.2-inch display with a fairly low-end processor and some very basic storage. It's meant to be kind of a starter phone, starter smartphone for people, but it has a great big screen on it. To make, you know, watching movies and doing things like that a lot easier. The big feature here is that it is a Verizon phone with a screen like this for $168.
Yeah, I mean, the price is the big thing here.
Right, and that's been Nokia's big thing for a while now is being able to offer kind of inexpensive phones. But the thing that comes with that is that these are inexpensive phones that from a performance perspective are actually really good. And they're running very modern versions of the Android operating system, and they're regularly getting software updates and security patches and things like that, which are things that don't normally happen with inexpensive phones. Inexpensive phones tend to not get software updates because it is expensive to do so.
Right.
Nokia has done a really good job of addressing that, making it that these are not only inexpensive phones, but that you can get, you know, that they remain relevant for quite some time.
Yeah, but you said it's a kind of a low-end processor.
It's going to be a little on the slow side compared to, you know, a Google Pixel or a Samsung Galaxy S10, but it's also $900 cheaper than a Galaxy S10. So you would expect there to be some drawback. And the camera is something that we don't know a whole lot about, but Nokia's cameras have historically not been the best, but they have been pretty good in most situations.
So $168, that's amazing, but you only get it at Verizon, which means you have to serve it. I mean, that's got to be your company, too.
Yeah, if you're on Verizon, you can go and pick up this phone. If you don't want to pay for it all at once, there is a month Verizon device payment plan that brings it down to $7 a month for 24 months.
Affordable for a lot of people, particularly good for kids?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is definitely something that we're going to take a look at for our kid recommendations. And just people who, you know, need a smartphone, but maybe not something that is, you know, insanely top of the line.
So what's getting lost as far as quality when you go down to $168?
You know, the biggest things there are probably going to be like raw speed and
just that
and the camera. Those are going to be kind of the two things that you'll probably see take a little bit of a hit.
And do you have less access to certain apps or anything like that because of that?
No, the apps will just take a little longer to load or you know, cause some some delay if you want to do things like video recording and things like that.
What's the advantage to Nokia? I mean, are they looking at the numbers sold at this point?
Yeah, Nokia's big, deal is being able to access these places in numbers. You know, so the sales, not just in the U.S. but also overseas, are you know, built on this kind of middle ground market where it's, you know, it's not the least expensive phone you can get, but it's in this kind of middle ground for people who want something that's slightly nicer. And they've been doing very, very well for the last 2 years releasing these phones in this area.
Let's see. Razer Blade. It's a new laptop, has a new laptop that's focused on gamers. And this is, I feel like we're having this conversation a lot more that whether it's a phone or it's a laptop that's focused on gamers. What features make it stand out?
The big thing for a laptop, and this is something that Razer has done very well for as long as it's been around, is making something with gaming focus really just means making a high-end machine with a very nice display and a capable graphics card and ports in it that are appropriate for accessories in, you know, this kind of form factor that looks almost like a modern MacBook. You know, it doesn't look like the huge, bulky gaming machine that most people think of when they think of gaming laptops that has, you know, these absurd keyboards and you know, kind of bright red and black flashy things on them. You know, it's been kind of toned down and not quite as silly looking. Razer's, you know, laptops have looked like this for a couple generations now. This is actually the first one of its kind, and this is a silly thing to get excited about. It comes in a color that isn't black.
And what color does it come in?
That's a silly thing. It comes in a really boring silver. So you have you know, all of Razer's laptops and most of their accessories have all come in this kind of matte black. And part of that is that it allows the rainbow-colored LEDs that are all throughout it to kind of stand out a little more. So that when you see these keyboards, the keyboards on both the laptops and the their normal desktop keyboards, the colors on the keys can shift to whatever color in the rainbow spectrum you want them to shift to. And in some cases, you can actually animate them so that they're constantly shifting from one color to the next. Because that makes you a better gamer, having access to bright colors. So this model, however, the thing that I really appreciate about what Razer has done here is by making it this kind of boring silver, this is a laptop that you can take kind of anywhere and it doesn't stand out as an absurd gaming machine. This just looks like a fairly ordinary laptop. The hardware that is in it, however, is far from it. This is a brand new processor. I'm going to list off a couple of really odd letters and numbers here real quick that you are perfectly forgiven to not totally understand. The NVIDIA GeForce RTX 2060, which is a brand new graphics card that was originally designed for desktops and has actually been kind of shrunk down for laptops, as well as a tremendous amount of storage and a display that is either a really beautiful HD display at 240 hertz or a 4K display that you can also use as a touchscreen, but not both of those things. You get one or the other.
The point here is that you want it to look boring and ordinary because it is anything but, and it is very expensive, $2,300.
These are never inexpensive machines. When Razer makes a laptop, they make a laptop that is specifically for the highest possible point to approach, you know, because the hardware that's in it is incredibly customized, and that comes with an obscene price point usually. The very least expensive version of this that you can get is $1,600, and it does, like you said, go up to $2,300 depending on some of the hardware options that are available. And it's not a light laptop either. It is a small laptop in that it looks very much like a modern MacBook Pro, but it is almost 5 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Which is pretty heavy.
It is definitely, yeah. For a laptop, it does not look like it would weigh this much when you see it.
Is it that heavy because of all the processor and the gobbledygook you just went over on the processor?
Yes. Well, it's a combination of things. The first thing there is the battery. In order to have a specialized battery in there to power this thing, it has to be a fairly dense battery, so that adds weight. And then also the cooling system that is in this is a magnesium coating to help with heat dissipation. So you have just kind of heavier materials in order to better dissipate heat.
You know, this might seem like a lot on a lot of levels, but the gaming world is bigger than ever.
It is certainly a big deal for you know, both entertainment and, you know, this kind of esports focus that has come to light over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But really, this is also a solid laptop for creative people. Video processing is something that several people on my team end up using these laptops for, because you can do it anywhere. You don't have to worry about going back to an office and using a desktop. And the same goes for high end photo editing and similar kind of, you know, resource heavy processes. This ends up being a really good machine for that.
And if you like to game on the side, all the better, right?
Exactly.
Do you have a special laptop devoted just to gaming?
No, actually I am kind of weird in my group of coworkers in that I prefer my laptops to be as minimalist as possible. I use the Surface Go, which is a super, super small, fairly underpowered system, to kind of go and you know, get work done as quickly and lightly as possible. I prefer the bag that I bring with me for travel and things like that to be incredibly light.
So you do your gaming kind of at home then?
Either at home or through something portable like a Nintendo Switch.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Bluetooth gets its share of criticism, and you argue that Bluetooth isn't bad. I don't mind it in my car, but you're talking about like earbuds and that kind of a thing?
Sort of. So there was an article that came out recently following some security research, and the big thing was that Bluetooth was bad and that you should stop using it, because that's how we operate in the tech world, is either everything is super positive or everything is super negative. And there's not a ton of room for nuance. So Bluetooth can be what is called a common attack vector, which means if you have Bluetooth on and you don't have any settings set to evaluate the things that are part of your Bluetooth system, there are tools called beacons that are frequently in grocery stores and things like that you can walk past and actually grab your Bluetooth information in order to present you with advertisements. The big thing there is if your Target app, for example, knows that you have been past a particular Bluetooth beacon in Target multiple times in a week, Target will frequently deliver advertisements to your account that says, hey, can you be here a couple of times? Here's something that will encourage you to shop a little more in this place. It is this way of kind of data collecting that is a little on the, it kind of walks the line between, you know, being safe and being unsafe, and anything like that can be exploited. There have been exploitation demonstrations for being able to use this to take advantage or to try and grab personal information. And it's just generally not great. Another example, a lot of laptops, particularly Apple laptops, have a feature called AirDrop that is on by default, and Bluetooth on those laptops are on by default. And there are a lot of stories of people using AirDrop to send things that are just wildly inappropriate. You know, there are horror stories of women being in airports and people using AirDrop to send inappropriate photos to them. And then, you know, the way that AirDrop works, it assumes that you are sending to a friend, and so it just immediately pops those things up on your screen without really giving you a whole lot of space for approval, because you've turned on Bluetooth and AirDrop is supposed to be this kind of local personal network, but it all runs on Bluetooth and there's not really a system to intercept those things because of the way Bluetooth works. So the general thought, behind this kind of gathering of warnings is that, you know, in everything that you have, you should just turn Bluetooth off. That is less true. You should be careful with how you use Bluetooth, and certainly not every single thing that you have needs to have Bluetooth on it every time. Your laptop is a pretty good example. Unless you have a Bluetooth accessory that you rely on consistently, you probably don't need to leave Bluetooth on all the time. But Bluetooth in and of itself is not a dangerous tool. And what it really comes down to is some of the other things that are tied into that, like location sharing. Location sharing is a great deal more dangerous than Bluetooth, and often they're used side by side. So it just ends up being a little deeper than just, you know, Bluetooth bad, turn it all the way off. And that was something I wanted to kind of bring up.
Thank you for doing that. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Russell Holley. Russell Holley's contributing editor for Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.